Emma Thompson may be best known by the role she's played so memorably on screen and stage, but today she joins us to tell us a different story, Elena's story. Elena's from a small town in Moldova, and at the age of 18, she was promised a job and a future in the United Kingdom. Instead, she was trafficked into the sex industry. Emma Thompson is hoping to raise awareness about women like Elena who are forced into the global sex trade. She's launching an art installation in New York next month and joins us from our studios in London. Emma Thompson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And please tell us about this art exhibit.
Well, I work with an extraordinary woman called Helen Bamber, who's 82 and started her life as a sort of human rights activist when she was aged 19. And it was through her, because I'm chair of her foundation, that I met one of our clients who had been, as you said, sold into this global industry. And it was a remarkable experience to sit in my little flat where I work for 2 hours one afternoon and have her tell me everything from the moment that she met this woman in the market who was really nice and had a family and said, you know what, I know that you're having difficulties and your father's just died and you can't go to school anymore and it's very frustrating, but I think I could get you a job as a doctor's receptionist in London and then you'd be able to save some money and be able to go back to school, and sold this lovely sounding life that Elena was so thrilled by. So she agreed to come here, and that was the beginning of this journey into hell. And she was sold by this woman to someone who then took her on a very long journey via Czechoslovakia and Dublin and Glasgow to London, where she was beaten and tortured and starved and forced to work as a prostitute. And she got out of it several years later. It's a very long story, and I don't know whether to tell you the whole thing because it would take quite some time. But she and I met, and we had a long process, really, where we talked about what she'd been through. And I said, how are we going to tell this story? Do you want to tell it in a film? Do you want to tell it in a play? Do you want to tell it? And we decided that some form of art, something that you went into that actually engaged you in a different way to just sitting and watching a screen, was very important, because you've already been objectified. And sometimes I think watching those things on the screen actually furthers or deepens that sense of objectification. So we...
It makes you into a character, not a person.
Well, yes, in a way. And also, you know, the person who's watching is just sitting there watching. They're not walking, they're not doing, they're not seeing and feeling things in a different way. So I thought, okay, how do I approach this? So I said to her, let's divide up the story into pieces and see whether we can make seven pieces. I chose, because seven's a magic storytelling number. And I'd already had this notion that shipping containers, just because they resonate so strongly, they're such powerful, huge objects, and we associate them with the movement of goods, mm-hmm. which is essentially how she was treated. I said, what about we take seven shipping containers and we into each one, we put one aspect of your journey, of your story, and we try to give people a sense of that journey, a real physical sense of that journey. And we set it in Trafalgar Square 2 years ago. And through the week that it sat in Trafalgar Square, 13,000 people walked through. And I remember one of the most extraordinary things about putting that together and the whole experience was when Elena came down herself to see the installation. It's very interesting, she kept saying. It's so interesting the way people listen. They want to listen. And I could see that the fact of their listening and hearing this story was having a very positive effect on her. And the next day she came down again and she said, you know, I'd like to volunteer. Because outside the end of the containers, and we will do this in New York as well, we had a lot of volunteers waiting to talk to people so that they could express what they felt, because it's a very difficult thing to experience. And I remember on one of the last days, I was marvelling at her bravery anyway, but a man came out, and he was a big, burly bloke. He looked rather sort of aggressive, actually, but he also looked as punch drunk, as though he'd been smacked in the face. And she went up to him and said, are you all right? And he came to almost, and he looked at her and he said, yes, yes, I but I'm afraid, he said, I'm afraid. And she said, why are you afraid? What are you afraid of? And he said, but it could be my sister, it could be my daughter, it could be anyone. And then he took her by the shoulders and he looked into her eyes and he said, this woman who it happened to, is she all right? And, you know, not knowing that he was talking to the very person upon whose story the whole installation was based. And she looked at him and she said, you know, she's fine. She's doing fine. And I realised that that experience had gone a long way towards healing her, that she, in her turn, was healing people who had, as it were, had a palimpsest of that experience through coming through the installation. And that, for me, I think, was the most profound moment of the whole endeavour.
Miss Thompson, this exhibit opens in Washington Square Park, I gather.
That's right, Washington Square. It opens to the public on the 10th and will be sitting there until the 16th, and I sit there with it. I'm there most of the time. So when people come out, they're able to talk to me too.
So you're not just jetting in and out.
No. I was there the whole time, the whole week. I was there in Trafalgar Square talking to people before they went in and talking to them afterwards. It's a very personal journey for me as well. It's very important for me to try to explain this as best as I can to people.
Would you forgive me for switching directions totally?
No, that's fine. I've blethered on forever.
I find a lot of people are intrigued by the fact, and even a little bit disbelieving, when I say, Emma Thompson, she got her start doing sketch comedy in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, I mean, I didn't want to be an actress. I wanted to be a comedian. I started writing sketch comedy when I was about 19, and when I went to Cambridge, the first people I met were Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. And so that kind of did it. Do you know
what
I mean?
That's pretty distinguished company anyway, yeah. So how, I'm afraid I don't know how you got from sketch comedy to Shakespeare and serious drama.
Well, I did. Hugh, Stephen and I went on when we left university doing sketch comedy for a living. After that, Robbie Coltrane was asked to do a television series called Tutti Frutti. They were looking for the girl, and I met these guys, and they said, yeah, here you go, we'd like you to do this. And I won my first BAFTA for that performance, and that was kind of it. Then they sort of said, okay, we want you to act. Please don't do any more comedy. We want you to act. But as I keep saying to young actors, you couldn't have a better start than doing comedy. Because A, it's harder than anything. B, it's more scary than anything, so anything you do after that won't be so scary. And C, it's the best possible training for your brain, because you have to think on your feet all the time.
Emma Thompson, she's launching an art installation in Washington Square. It's already been mounted at Trafalgar Square in London, depicting the journey of women trafficked into the sex industry. Emma Thompson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
American schools have struggled to close what's called the minority achievement gap, lower average test scores, grades, and college attendance rates among Black and Latino students. Typically, children who are falling behind are placed in remedial classes intended to help them catch up. But some schools are starting to say that the way they group students by ability, often called tracking or leveling, can cause more problems than they solve. Nancy Solomon spent last year as a Spencer Fellow in Education reporting to examine why good suburban schools are failing Black students.
The hallways at Columbia High School in Maplewood, New Jersey, are a picture postcard of integration. Columbia is a well-funded school that's roughly 60% Black and 40% white. The kids mix easily with a super-friendly vibe. But when the bell rings, students go their separate ways. This is Noel Cooperberg's repeat algebra class, a class of all minority kids who flunked last year. There are only about a dozen students. The school keeps lower-level classes small to try to boost success. But a group of girls sitting in the middle never so much as pick up a pencil, and disrupt the class throughout. It's an entirely different scene in Cooper Berg's honors-level pre-calculus class, which has three times as many students, and most of them are white. These two classes are pretty typical. Lower-level classes, called levels 2 and 3, are overwhelmingly black, while 4 and 5 are mostly white. Students are assigned to these levels by a combination of grades, test scores, and teacher recommendations.
You could look at the highest achieving kid and the lowest achieving kid and say, oh my God, they're worlds apart, right?
The problem, says Amy Stuart Wells of Columbia University's Teachers College, is how kids in the vast middle are sorted. The racial segregation corresponds to the difference in average test scores between black and white students at the school and nationally. But Stuart Wells says racial stereotypes still play a role.
And what you're seeing in suburbia and how it's playing out along racial lines is testimony to the fact that race still matters quite a bit in this society and very much so in education.
The two towns served by the school are diverse, middle-class suburbs, although a third of the students are low-income and almost all of those kids are black. But a considerable number of the African-American students are middle and upper-middle class.
My name's Hanif Quinn. I was born and raised here. I'm 16 years old. I'm a very intellectual student. I think I'm really actually the smartest underachiever in Columbia High School.
Hanif lives in a large house in a solidly middle-class neighborhood. He has two older siblings who've gone on to college, and he says his parents pushed him to do well. His freshman year, Hanif was placed in level 4 classes, one of a small group of African-American students.
We kind of sat together, the black kids over here and the white kids over here. It seemed like the teacher, she just stayed on the other side of the room away from us. The teacher focused on the larger group of whites and left us in the dust.
I've heard that so many times.
Columbia principal Lovey Lilly, who is African-American, is troubled by the racial segregation in leveled classes. She says the levels do reflect differences in skill and work habits, but she believes race plays a part. Lily conducted research on the experience of black students at her school while studying for her PhD.
Black children in higher level classes were ignored or perceived that they were being ignored, or they did not feel comfortable going to the teacher after school to get help. They gave up and decided to go to level 3 classes, where at least there were other black children.
But this comfort comes with a penalty. Lower level classes ask less of students, so they do less. The school district's new superintendent, Brian Osborne, who is white, says the lack of rigor in lower levels is his top priority for change.
The second day that I was here as superintendent, I met with a group of middle school students for lunch. And I asked the students, what are your teachers' expectations of you? And the very first thing that one of the students told me was, it depends what level you're in.
The question Osborne has yet to answer is whether lower level classes can hold students to higher standards, or whether any sorting system sends the wrong message.
Our first day, you know, going to that class, we made a nickname for the class. We called it the retarded class.
Jerry Mournville, a recent graduate, remembers his level 2 class and how the low expectations affected the way students felt about themselves and about school.
We were mad. A lot of kids, you know, were being rude to the teachers and stuff like that. That class was crazy. It was like every African-American or black ethnic friend I knew in my grade, they were all in that class.
For the past 20 years, proposals to get rid of levels at the school have been defeated by the well-organized parents of highest-performing students, who tend to be affluent and white, and who fear their kids will be slowed down by mixed-ability classes. Teachers are also divided. Richard Moss is an African-American math teacher with 37 years' experience.
I've done both. When you have kids mixed together, then you're going to find that this group of kids at this level cannot work at the same level as someone else, okay? So that it makes it difficult to organize, and then the frustration level increases at both ends.
So we're ready for the squire now. So
on the other side of this issue is Lean Marshall, who teaches a demanding medieval literature class to a mixed group of kids from levels 2, 3, and 4. The class began as a scheduling mistake, but it turned out to work.
Which of you is going to present the Squire? Chanel?
Lean Marshall is calling on Chanel Saint, who's been in level 2 classes since middle school. Yet here he is in Marshall's class, explaining the character of the Squire in the Canterbury Tales, and doing it well.
Great, Chanel. A lot of fire.
I saw in the kids who wanted the opportunity a light open up. The kids who had been used to, I guess, doing very basic work, whose English classes, for whatever reason, hadn't been challenging, would come up to me and say, we've just never thought this way before. No one's ever asked us these questions before.
Superintendent Brian Osborne is moving gingerly toward change. He's created a task force to study leveling in Maplewood, and he's hoping to convince parents that education is not a zero-sum game, that the schools can boost the lowest performers while improving achievement for all. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Solomon.
And tomorrow in the second part of our series, we'll explore how race matters in the education of teenagers. Visit npr.org to see audio slideshows about Columbia High School. Sometimes in art, one has to make the ultimate sacrifice. Sacrificium is the title of a new album of opera arias by the Italian mezzo-soprano Cecilia Bartoli. She joins us now from the studios of the Swiss Broadcasting Corporation in Zurich. Ms. Bartoli, thanks so much for being with us.
Hello. Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And we'll say this very carefully. This is an album of music written for castrati, young men whose manhood was maimed so their singing voices wouldn't break.
Yeah, castrati were the singers, the pop singers of 18th century. And most of this music is part of the school, the Napoletanish school, you know. And just to give you an example, the one of the greatest castrato of the Napoletanish school was Farinelli. And the teacher of Farinelli was Porpora, Nicola Porpora. And in this project, we have a lot of music composed by Porpora himself, yes.
I certainly don't mind telling you, and it's, I think, clear from the liner notes that you yourself think, in the 21st century, this is a pretty twisted idea. Who said, I know, we need a high singing voice, this is what we'll do? How did this come about?
Well, this is a story about, as you mentioned, sacrificium of thousands of boys. So the sacrifice of hundreds of thousands of boys in the name of music. But in fact, most of these boys were coming from very poor family of the south of Italy, you know, with 10, 12 children. One child was sacrificed on the name of music because they were hoping that these boys were making a career and save the family from the poverty, you know, because as I said before, so being a Caffarelli or Farinelli was like being a pop star, was like being Michael Jackson, you know what I mean? Yeah. This is really was a big business in 18th century, but of course it probably is the most cruel story in the history of music.
Let's hear some of the music because it is hauntingly beautiful.
Yes.
Of course, that's not castrati, castrato singing now.
No, it's a good point. No, it's not a castrato. It's me, so, and I'm not a castrato, I'm a mezzo, lyric mezzo, high mezzo, but with a big passion for Baroque music and from, it's fun, and for, especially for Porpora. So this was a music composed by Porpora, beautiful aria, parto, ti lascio cara, and the opera is Germanico in Germania.
If we could hear kind of another dimension of the music. That was hauntingly beautiful. This is kind of fast and furious.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else in the world arguably sings like you, but is this more difficult to sing than other pieces anyway?
Well, this is... it's difficult, but it's clear that if you want to perform this music, you need a lot of breath control. And this was an aria composed by Francesco Araya, which is not really a well-known composer, but he composed this piece, and the aria is Cadrò ma qual si mira. So castrati were men singing with a female voice, but the body was the body of a man. And this is, I think, is the challenge, I mean, for women to perform this repertoire, because, of course, we cannot really compare the capacity of oxygen in a lung, you know, than a woman has compared to a man. So breath control is extremely important.
What fascinated you about the music? The music, the story, all of it?
From one side, you have the most beautiful, probably, music composed in 18th century. And from the other side, you have the most cruel story of 18th century. So this is, I think, this cruelty and beauty and cruelty in one project. You know, this is, I think it's extremely fascinating, yes. And it's a big discovering also, because most of this music never been recorded before.
I want to listen here, if we could, some more music. This, this again, Nicola Porpora, startling piece here. Imitating a nightingale?
Yes, so, kind of nightingale, you're right. Every good castrato had to sing, or at least every good castrato was asking a composer to compose an aria, a nightingale aria, yes. And the voice of a castrato, they really had an amazing technique also, so they had a possibility to sing in a very low register to the very high register, and with an extremely flexibility in the voice, and they, of course, they had to also imitate all the beautiful instrument we have in nature, and birds, and other instrument too. Yeah,
you know, obviously, what happened to castrati was cruel and indefensible, but I guess I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that they really were celebrated personages, weren't they? As you say, the rock stars of their day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the one who they had the possibility to make a career, they really had an amazing life. I mean, they really were pop stars. So, but the name Sacrificium, so the title of this recording, is in order to remember the one, the castrati, they had no possibility to make a career, which were the majority, you know, because in Italy they were castrating between 3,000 and 4,000 boys every year, and only one or two of them, they really had a big career, you know. In fact, the one that they had the possibility to make a career, at least they had the satisfaction of success, of money, and things like that. But, of course, they also, even themselves, they had a very difficult life, you know, because to be a castrato, so they were in one way loved by the society, and in the other way they were rejected because they were no men, no women. So it's really, really a tragic story. It's one, as I said before, glorious, you know, the tragedy and the glory, you know.
Ms. Bartoli, thanks so much. Very good talking to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Cecilia Bartoli's new release is called Sacrificium, and you can see photos of Cecilia Bartoli and hear the new CD in its entirety, what a bargain, on our website, nprmusic.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The New York City restaurant scene can be fierce, competitive, and bankrupting. But David Chang is doing well. 32 years old, he already has 4 critically acclaimed restaurants, another on the way. Now he's written a cookbook. NPR's David Gura has this profile.
On a weekday at lunch, Mama Fuku Noodle Bar in the East Village is packed with people. Customers gathered outside the restaurant before it opened. Now they've crowded around wood tables. They line the bar that borders the open kitchen. Michael Bedrick is from Manhattan. He says he's been to the restaurant once a week, every week, for 2 years.
You have to be somewhat adventurous here, I think, to have the full experience. I don't think you want to just come here and have the ramen. I mean, you should have the ramen, but you should sort of experiment here. I think that's what it's about. It's sort of an alchemy of different things.
It is eclectic. There are pickled cherries and Tokyo turnips, pan-roasted asparagus with miso butter, and Sichuan crawfish with dried red chilies, soy sauce, and scallions. But it's the ramen that made Mama Fuku famous.
There's pieces of pork belly, a poached egg, some crispy pork shoulder, some greens, and a really beautifully done ramen noodle. The texture is lovely. It has a really nice toothiness to it.
Diner Josefa Concannon is from Chicago. The proprietor of this place, the head chef, David Chang, is a bear of a guy with a boyish face. He's Korean-American, he grew up in Virginia just outside of Washington, and he worked hard to get those noodles to taste just right, to get that nice toothiness Concannon liked. Chang traveled to Japan, where he ate a lot of ramen, and he started cooking professionally before it was cool, he says.
All my friends were like, "You're an idiot. What the hell are you doing? Come bank, go bank, be a lawyer, be a doctor, work at this .com. Everyone's working at .com. Now, it's different. It's very strange that you can get recognition because of cooking. I have a hard time dealing with that.
By now, Chang's gotten plenty of recognition, certainly enough to silence his college buddies. James Beard Awards, Michelin stars, and lots of good reviews. He says that his rise to the top of the New York restaurant world was fast, but it wasn't easy. Peter Meehan used to review restaurants for the New York Times. He remembers his first visit to Chang's Noodle Bar, which used to be just up the street in a tiny space in an old fried chicken shop no wider than a one-car garage.
The first time I went there, it was pretty bad. You know, the noodles were overcooked, the ramen was too salty.
It was so bad, he didn't even review it.
And then about 6 months later, I kept hearing from people that this place is great, you got to go back. And I went back and you know, I was head over heels about it and went back a few times and wrote a pretty glowing review of it.
Chang got a following and a reputation for his cooking, for his irreverence, and, Meehan says, for his temper.
Korean termites was what they'd call the holes he used to punch in the wall of all the kitchens, you know. There was a point where they had like 20 pictures of Frank Bruni all up over the kitchen walls, but it was basically just to cover holes in the drywall that Dave had punched.
There's still a photo of Frank Bruni, the former restaurant critic for the New York Times, on the wall downstairs. But Chang has settled down. He's learning how to be a better manager, and the walls look pretty solid. But fame has taken its toll on him. His restaurant has grown into a small empire. He travels around the world to conferences, to give speeches, to judge cooking competitions.
I am still burnout. I had to like look up the term burnout, and it seemed like I had the checklist and everything was there. I was like, I just tired of looking at food, tired of thinking about food, tired of it all, but I still love it, if that makes any sense. And I've been able to work with food, but not on an everyday basis.
We head into the kitchen, which is bustling. He's at home here, no question. The lunch rush is on, and Chang's team of chefs is scrambling to prepare for dinner. Chang grabs a piece of striped bass, some thyme, some garlic, a hunk of butter, and he gets to work. In a couple of minutes, the fish is on a plate with a side of broccoli romanesco. David Chang's food is hard to classify. Is it Japanese? He dismisses that suggestion. Korean? No, it's not that either. It's delicious, he says, and American.
The Dave Chang cop-out on that is pretty good. Sometimes he calls it bad pseudo-fusion cuisine.
Peter Meehan is working with David Chang to, in his words, reclaim the word fusion, to give it new meaning. He's out of the reviewing business, and he and Chang have collaborated on a new cookbook. And in that book, there's the recipe for that famous ramen. And if you decide to make it, clear your calendar. It's time-intensive, and it isn't easy. From broth to bamboo shoots, it takes up almost 20 pages. David Gura, NPR News.
And you can find Ava Chang's recipe for Fuji apple salad with kimchi and smoked jowl. Who's jowl? On our website, npr.org. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. There's an old joke. How do you become a millionaire? Have $1 billion, then buy the Chicago Cubs. Well, Tom Ricketts is that man. Mr. Ricketts is the chief executive officer of InCapital, a Chicago investment bank, and a director of Ameritrade, and now owner of the Chicago Cubs. He bought the storied franchise in its famous ballpark, Wrigley Field, for almost $900 million, the most ever paid for a baseball team and its park. And I believe, I'll check the facts on this, that it's a team that hasn't won a World Series for more than a century. Tom Ricketts joins us now from the studios of Chicago Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
Did you buy the Cubs for love or money?
Well, I think it's going to be a fair investment over time, but you don't buy sports teams just because you're looking at the investment side of it. It's a love of the family. We love the field. We're looking forward to being part of it, and we're looking forward to getting rid of that 100-year reference you just made.
Well, can you tell us whether or not you're going to increase ticket prices?
Yeah, nothing's been decided on that yet. I think that they might go up a little bit overall for next year, but we haven't made any final determinations on that.
And if I might sound like a cranky, garrulous fan for a moment, why would they go up at all? It's certainly not as if the team played any better.
Yeah, the fact is that it's pretty expensive to put a team on the field. I think that the key that all fans, garrulous or not, should keep in mind is that with family ownership now, we intend to reinvest all the profits that we can get on the team and put that back into preserving Wrigley Field and to putting a better team on the field. So it's not like it's going away to some kind of corporation and never to be seen again. You know, we're all kind of in this together from our perspective.
Speaking as a businessman, do player salaries make sense to you?
In baseball, the players, you know, a lot of those players create a lot of value for those teams. It seems like a lot of money, but as a free market guy, I guess I'd have to say that if those people are getting those kind of salaries, then they're justifying it economically somehow.
Mm-hmm. Do you prefer to build a team for the minor league system or go for some big-name free agents?
Scott, undoubtedly, the way to build a long-term winner is through player development. You've got to draft the right people, and you've got to have scouts and coaches that are coordinated and working together to turn the right players into real producers at the major league level. Free agency, I think, is something that is something you look at when you've got a hole to fill or when you haven't been able to produce a player from your own system. The real key for consistent performance and trying to win the division every single year is developing our own players.
Johnny Damon of the Yankees is an outfielder, free agent. Carl Pavano of the Twins, pitcher, good one, is a free agent. Any interest?
Those decisions are to be made by the general manager. Mm-hmm. I don't have any feeling for whether or not Jim has any interest in any particular free agent at this point.
So Jim Henry is going to remain as the general manager?
That's true, yes. Jim is staying on as general manager. I think everyone was disappointed by the performance in 2009, particularly coming off a great 2008. But overall, I think Jim's done a good job of kind of bringing the team up to the level that they're at with three playoff appearances in the last 7 years. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give him the opportunity to put us over the hump next year in 2010.
Do you want Lou Piniella to stay on as Cub manager?
I do. We think Lou is one of the best managers in baseball. He has an option to return next year. And from what I understand, I think he's planning to.
You know, Wrigley Field is not only great, but in the opinion of many people, it's the franchise in the sense that no matter how well or not well the Cubs play, there's a great turnout for people to see Wrigley Field. But players sometimes point out there's not the room for training facilities, offices, that sort of thing, that have become accepted at the major league level. There's always some talk of the Cubs maybe purchasing adjacent land nearby to build something. Do you have anything you can say on that?
Yeah, a couple thoughts on that. First of all, we want this to be the best franchise in baseball, and you can't be a world-class franchise and have third-class facilities, and we see that. We really understand that there's things that we have to improve inside the stadium from the player perspective. With respect to how we do that, it's linked to the second half of your question, which is there is land that is just adjacent to the stadium along Clark Street that the team owns, and we intend to develop that into a part of the stadium that will give fans more options on game day, but as importantly, free up space inside of the stadium to build in some of the clubhouse functionality that other teams enjoy. things like a, you know, like a batting cage or a video room or a place where the players can sit quietly. I mean, those are kind of things that we have to look at building in. But it's all part of the stadium redesign that accompanies the addition to the stadium, which will allow us to move a lot of the current things that are in the stadium out of the stadium so we have some more space.
Is there a franchise, as you look at Major League Baseball, that inspires you and makes you think, if they can do that, maybe I can try something like that with the Cubs?
Well, you know, the Cubs are unique. I think there's some analogies you can see from other teams out there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Cubs are a special kind of one-of-a-kind franchise. So I'm not sure there's any one team that you can just point to right away. Mm-hmm. I think, obviously, what they've done with Fenway is a good thing for us to look at in terms of how to improve the stadium, because we really do want to preserve and keep improving the special experience that Wrigley Field is. Mm-hmm. On the field, you know, we also wouldn't mind copying the Red Sox. I think it's time for the team to push forward and to win a World Series.
Mm. Tom, what do you look forward to?
I look forward to opening day. I look forward to being at every game. I look forward to winning the World Series.
Boy, that's not too much, is it?
Not too much to ask, I don't think.
Every game you think you might get to?
Unless there's some kind of family commitment that prevents me from doing so, I suppose. I'll be at many games.
Stephen Bartman, the poor guy a lot of Cub fans blame for snatching the foul ball away from Moises Alou 2003 playoffs that they feel kept the Cubs out of the World Series. Would you welcome Stephen Bartman back to Wrigley Field?
I'm sure that if he wants to come back, it would be fine with me. I don't have any issue with him. And on top of that, Scott, it's like I think one message that we have out for every fan is let's let bygones be bygones. What's happened in the past is behind us. There is no curse. There's no billy goat. There's none of that stuff. Let's move on. We're one of the best teams in baseball. We will be the best team in baseball going forward. And we just have to look forward, not backward.
You nicely set up my last question. Yeah. Mr. Ricketts, sir, can you use a right-hander in the bullpen for late inning relief?
You know, I'm sure
I'm volunteering, if that was not.
Volunteering?
Yeah.
Will you work for league minimum?
Are you kidding? It's got to beat what I'm making now, and yes, I'd pay you.
Fair enough. We'll take a look at that.
No commitments. You're very canny, talking like an owner already. You know, years ago when Barbara Walters finished an interview with Jimmy Carter just before he was sworn in as president, she said, "Mr. President, be good to us, be kind to us." If I may, on behalf of all Cub fans... Be good to us. Be kind to us, if you could.
Well, you know, on behalf of the family, we're fans too. And we feel the pain of the fans. We understand the magic that is Wrigley. We understand everything that goes into it. So it is our singular goal to get us to the promised land and to start being more consistent and get to that World Series. And I hopefully we'll be on the show again soon and we'll be talking about what it was like to win.
I hope so. Tom Ricketts, new owner of the Chicago Cubs. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Hey, hey, hold a mackerel. No doubt about it. The Cubs are on their way. They've got the hustle. They've got the muscle. The Chicago Cubs are on their way. The Audacity of Hope, weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
S.E. Hinton, the novelist and lifelong Oklahoman, says Oklahoma doesn't have a climate. It has weather.
You never know if sprinkles are going to turn into floods, if a high wind's going to turn into a tornado, if that pelting rain is going to turn into hail.
Oklahoma's in the smack dab middle of the funnel shape that runs between Minnesota and Texas, that's sometimes called Tornado Alley. Especially in the spring. Hurricanes are the onrushing trains of storms, vast and destructive, but you can see them growing fatter with ocean waters and whirling for days in advance. Tornadoes get whipped up in an afternoon. You can't evacuate a town in advance of a tornado because they strike suddenly, like a bank safe falling out of a window. Blue, sunny skies turn suddenly dark and stormy.
You're always on your toes. You scan the skies. You check the Weather Channel first thing in the morning, and you watch the evening television just for the news, especially if you've spotted a cloud the size of a small hand on the horizon that morning, because you never know what that's going to blow up to.
So in Oklahoma, TV meteorologists aren't just comic relief between news and sports. They don't just tell you when to take an umbrella to work or put an extra blanket on your bed, but when to cover your backside. The preeminent meteorologist in Oklahoma is Gary England. He's been at KWTV Channel 9 in Oklahoma City since 1972 and has won Emmys, Murrow Awards, and scores of other honors. He played a TV weatherman in the movie Twister and was a consultant to the film, too. Although Mr. England is often credited as the first meteorologist to make use of Doppler radar images to predict and depict weather, he began his career with more basic tools.
You know, I had basically a map of the United States, a map of Oklahoma, and I used chalk and magnetic numbers and letters. Now it's rather sophisticated, and it's so high-tech, and you have this moving and that moving, and people look at those computer models, and they think they're real, and they're not real.
He says even meteorologists sometimes forget that the images they can now present of how storms and clouds may move through the skies over the next few days are merely computer projections.
Every time I bring a new kid in here, I have to work with him to say, keep in mind this is not real, even though it looks so wonderful and so perfect. You have to use your abilities that you learn in college. You have to use your experience, your intuition, all those things to say, is this really what's going to happen? Does this look like anything I've seen before? What did it do last time it came through? They're not real.
Real Oklahoma weather can range from drought to hail in a single day. It's happened. In an average year, the state will be struck by 50 tornadoes. But one memorable day, a single day, there were even more.
You mentioned a day, and was it 1999, and there were 60 tornadoes?
May 3rd.
What was that day like for you?
Pretty scary. Pretty wild. It was like many other days. You know, you expected severe thunderstorms, few tornadoes, which is pretty normal for springtime in this part of the world. And even that morning, we expected severe thunderstorms and a few tornadoes. It took a while, I think, for everyone to realize it was a very significant event.
How did you alert people, cover that, deal with it?
Well, for years, I've said, you know, tornado warning for Oklahoma County. All residents continue with tornado precautions. Today with News 9, we'll keep you advised. And that's been heard thousands and thousands of times by the people of Oklahoma. On that day, I realized I had to say something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And I said, don't go outside and look at this thing. It will kill you. And then shortly after that, I said, most structures will not withstand this tornado. Then I got to the point, I said, you know, you need to be below ground level to survive. And I knew that one would get their attention because I'd never said it before and I've never said it since. You need to be below ground level to survive. And they listened.
44 people died in Oklahoma, May 3rd, 1999. Who knows how many more might have been harmed if Gary England hadn't bluntly told them to go below ground. That's why Essie Hinton says that in Oklahoma, meteorologists are regarded in some of the same goodly light as football coaches and rodeo champs. In Oklahoma, do meteorologists become celebrities in the same
rock
way?
Rock stars.
Okay.
Rock
yes.
stars.
So news stations in Oklahoma field teams of meteorologists who don't just point at storms on a screen, but chase after them as if Beyonce had just come to town. They're called storm chasers, and Channel 9's top chaser is considered to be Val Castor of Stillwater, just north of Oklahoma City.
Anybody chases storms a little bit odd, you know, a little strange. And Val's one of my closest friends, and I'll be the first day he's a little bit odd when it comes to storms, but he loves them.
I'll say this, God has given me a passion for chasing storms, and I'm happy.
We caught up with Val Castor in his pickup truck, which is stripped down and outfitted with gauges, sensors, and laptop computers, on which he can follow a storm that he can look dead in the face. While Gary England's in the studio telling Oklahomans to get below ground, Val Castor's on top of that very ground, trying to catch up with the storm that's making normal people take cover.
You know, when I'm out there chasing, most of the time I'm pretty calm, and he's learned how to read me. Whenever my voice goes up, the excitement level goes up, he pretty much knows it's real.
Have you ever been in a situation where you thought, this is it?
You know, we try to stay in a safe part of the storm, but, you know, every now and then, if you chase long enough, you're going to come across times when the storm might surprise you. And actually, one time this last year, we had a small tornado pass right over the truck. Very weak tornado, luckily for us. All it did was push us into the ditch.
Well, that raises the question. I mean, with five kids, do you ever ask yourself, is one more damn tornado worth it?
I feel a lot safer chasing the tornado than I do at home, sitting there waiting on it to hit me. If I'm out chasing it, I can get behind it, keep it in front of me all day long, and not have to worry about it.
By the way, Val Castor's wife, Amy, is also a storm chaser and often joins him in the truck. A trusted babysitter takes their children into their storm cellar at home. While it's tempting to see storm chasers as men and women who draw some electric charge from danger, Val Castor says that seeing storms close up actually recharges his faith in even greater powers.
I'm a Christian, and I have faith in Jesus Christ. And if I die, I know that I'm taken care of. And so I don't know how anybody can chase storms and not know what their destiny is when they die.
And S.E. Hinton, the novelist, says the very capriciousness of Oklahoma's weather, the chance that a single day might begin with dry prairie heat but lead to hailstorms, kind of renews her faith in the humility of human beings, too.
There's just something so uncontrolled about the weather. We like to think that humankind has got a lot of things under control, but nobody thinks the weather is under control.
Another Oklahoma story next week. The hottest restaurant in town doesn't get anything hotter than 105 degrees. Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.